This is Dialogue Conspiracy. Political research specialist Mae Bressel, whose conspiracy newsletter appears in the Realist magazine, has for 3 years shared with our listeners the fruits of her decades' research into political assassinations and the abuses of power in America. Her weekly commentary relates the news of the week to the evidence emerging about the conspiracy, which allegedly maintains its power by force over America's electoral and executive processes. And now, here's Mae.
Good afternoon. This is Dialogue Conspiracy. It's June 17th. It's 2 years since the arrest at the Watergate Hotel in Washington, D.C. It's an anniversary of sorts. I've never worked so hard as I have in the past 2 years keeping track of all the material. At that time, I'd done 8 years of research into political assassinations, and I recognized immediately that this was the team that were operating to overthrow the government consistently since 1960. I picked up the phone the next day and called Bernard Fensterwald, who's now James McCord's attorney, and he's a friend of mine, a co-researcher, and I said, these are our boys. Of course, in Washington, he knows more than I do, but he didn't seem to be aware at that time that he was aware of the connections of the Watergate arrests to the period of political assassinations in the last 8 years. At that time, it's 10 years now. And he had me call Fletcher Prouty, also, his name, wrote The Secret Team. And they had lunch that day, and I ran down what I thought was taking place there, and sure enough, that was it. And within 3 weeks, I just sat down and did nothing but write a story. The complete story of the Watergate affair, what they were doing, the motives in the Democratic headquarters. I've collected several thousand files on the subject. And when most of the books are done, like the Woodward Bernstein now and Jeb Magruder and all these different people come in and do their interpretive history of what took place, I will sit back within the next couple of years and show how they systematically covered up what they're really doing in the Democratic headquarters. And while they're just at the edge of admitting now what they were doing, they can't go right over the brink and tell the truth about the events in the headquarters. Jack Anderson, who seems to be the mouthpiece for a lot of people in this country, and a friend of Frank Sturgis, one of the men arrested for 20 years, came out right away and said that the motive for the Cubans and McCord and Hunt being in the Democratic offices was to see how much money from Cuba was given to McGovern. That wasn't the motive, and they tried to use that for a long time. Then they wanted to see if Larry O'Brien had damaging information on the ITT that would ruin Nixon's chance of election, and then that motive was thrown out the window. Then they wanted to see the link of Howard Hughes to the Nixon brothers and donations of Bebe Rebozo to Richard Nixon tied into the information in Hank Greenspan's office and the fact that Larry O'Brien worked for Hughes. And then that motive was thrown out the window. And the latest explanation of Jack Anderson just last week was that the target was Ted Kennedy. What they really wanted to do since 1969, Jack Anderson said, Nixon had scarcely settled in the White House in 69 before he began seeking political ammunition to use against Kennedy and O'Brien. The history that I will write, what I have collected, is that what they were doing in the office, they weren't sure that Ted Kennedy wouldn't take the nomination at the last minute down in Florida, and this is written up in the Jack Anderson article. Maybe McGovern would step aside and Muskie and Kennedy would take the nomination in July, at which time he would be able to win the election easily from Richard Nixon. And what they were doing in the office, and it's 2 years now, and the documentation backs it up, but they're too afraid to say it, they were planting the evidence inside the Democratic headquarters with provocateurs who are Republicans or intelligence agents disguised as Democrats in telephone conversations and in files and mail in order to link McGovern to radicals. And in the event that Ted Kennedy got the nomination down in Florida in 1972 in July, in the interim between August, when Nixon was nominated, and the election in November, a series of violences would be created, and particularly the Republican convention and around the country, that would require martial law and stop the Democrats from getting elected. They wouldn't kill the third Kennedy, but they had the contingency for martial law, and that's what I said 3 years ago today, because they have had this contingency to overthrow the government in the event that a Democrat would win the election. That's what I said then, and I say it now, and I will write it, the definitive book, maybe in another couple of years. I want to go into an analysis of the Watergate in the last 2 years, what's happened, the charges, what was revealed, but I want to also keep up with current events because a lot of the summaries of Watergate are coming out this week. And I did say that the men involved at the Watergate, the team, were linked to the John Kennedy assassinations and all the political assassinations, and that was the first allegation in the country 3 weeks after they were arrested. The Zodiac News Service had an article this week about Richard Sprague, who I've quoted on my programs many times, and he says he released new evidence that says there's links between the Central Intelligence Agency, E. Howard Hunt, and CIA operatives to the 1963 assassination of President Kennedy. Sprague has a new article coming out in the magazine Computers and People. He charges there were a series of meetings, secret meetings, attended by Lee Harvey Oswald, Clay Shaw, David Ferry, held in Mexico City to plan the assassination 2 months before Kennedy was killed in Dallas. The meetings were held at Mexico City apartment of CIA operative named Guy Gabaldon. Sprague says information about this meeting in Gabaldon's apartment was provided to his committee by two members of the CIA, former members named Richard Case and Harry Dean, who attended the planning sessions. And Sprague states that E. Howard Hunt, later arrested at the Watergate, was the station chief for the CIA in Mexico City at the time these alleged meetings were held, and that Hunt either organized them or knew that they were taking place, and he sanctioned them. And Sprague adds he has uncovered collaborative evidence about the CIA's role in the JFK death from Victor Barchetti, the former CIA assistant. And this new article will be coming out in Computers and People. It alleges that the Warren Report had said that Oswald was in Mexico City in the fall of 63, but they passed off that his trip to Mexico had nothing to do with the John Kennedy assassination later. He was carrying the name and address and telephone number of FBI agent James Hostie on his person when he was arrested. Lee Harvey Oswald was in Dallas. Well, I brought this, on top of this news service of Richard Sprague's, was another item in the news this week, Zodiac News, about, and it links to this last thing I was reading to you, an Illinois psychiatrist by the name of Tutor, T-U-T-E-U-R, Werner Tutor, an Illinois psychiatrist, interviewed Ruby on four occasions in 65 and concluded that Jack Ruby was a paranoid schizophrenic and never should have stood trial. And Dr. Werner Tutor, who says Ruby was mentally disturbed and that he saw Ruby before he died, and that Ruby went around telling people that there was a conspiracy that involved a dancer at Ruby's nightclub and a high-level member of the members of the government. And Ruby, according to Dr. Tutor, in a new article in Mental Health, reported in prison interviews that Ruby wanted to say that he was set up to kill Oswald so that Oswald would be silenced forever, and that there was a conspiracy behind the president's assassination, but in his view, Ruby was a paranoid individual. So I thought I'd bring in today some research that I have about the connection of Jack Ruby, David Ferry, Clay Shaw, Oswald, and the Mexico City apartment. And apropos of that, I was looking up that research to prepare the program for today, and I came across something which is a first, and a lot of you will share my excitement at this. And I spoke to Don Fried this morning and other researchers. On other programs, I've talked about being in correspondence with a gentleman and who calls me every 10 days or so and is interested in my research, has been since I wrote my first article 2 years ago in The Realist. And this man lived not too far, maybe 100, 200 miles from a university that I was going to speak in the Midwest this last Thanksgiving. So I told him to meet me. He was interested in my work. And when I met him and spent time with him that evening, I freaked out because through the conversation and the way we met and the place that we met, I realized that this was the second Oswald. You've heard me talk on many, many shows in the last 3 years about a second Oswald. And I've referred, there's a book by Popkin called The Second Oswald. There's about 17 incidences of a second Oswald. And last night when I was looking at my research of Jack Ruby and David Ferry in the Mexico apartment and E. Howard Hunt's station job down there in Mexico for the CIA at the time, I came across material that I hadn't looked for 3 years because I have so much research. And the gentleman that has been in touch with me regularly is that second Oswald, and described in material from a lawyer investigator in the Southwest, they describe this person as being the exact duplicate of Oswald, except that his hair was a little thicker. And this particular man was exchanging $150,000 between Canada and Grand Bahamas and Mexico City, and he worked with two agents, Breck Wall and Joe Peterson, who were friends of Jack Ruby's. Now, I'm hoping that this particular person that I've been in touch with will surface soon for lawyers and for the news media, because if two men are working with Dick Sprague, who were involved in the Mexico City CIA part of the conspiracy, and if two men are working with James Ray's lawyer this week, who say one of them shot Martin Luther King and they want immunity for the four rich men in the South that hired him to do that murder, then I hope that this friend of mine, who I've been in regular contact, will surface. It'll be one of the big clues in the whole story to know personally and be in contact continuously with a person who I know was the second Oswald, and then get documentation, because a lot of these men didn't use aliases like David Fearing, Clay Shaw, and E. Howard Hunt in their jobs. They did not use aliases. And this man did not use an alias. All the time I've known him, he doesn't have an address or a phone where I can reach him. He reaches me. But he's the same name, the same exact appearance, and I'm really excited about that. Well, the connection down in the idea that Ruby is a schizophrenic and that he has these delusions of working with a dancer at the nightclub are not delusions at all. The name of the dancer, her name was Tammy True, and she worked with several people. Two of the gunmen stayed at her house on November 23rd. That was the day before Jack Ruby shot Lee Harvey Oswald. I have a description of one man, William Seymour, who fired a rifle from the sixth floor, and he left in a white Nash Rambler, and he was one of the men that helped shoot Officer Tippett over in the Oak Cliff section of town. There was a double fire. It wasn't Oswald that shot Tippett. It was an excuse to arrest Tippett, and Seymour hid out in the Abundant Life Temple, which is on the corner of the street in the Oak Cliff section. And James Powell, who worked for Permandex, he was an agent of the Defense Intelligence Security Command, he stayed in the book depository, and he was trapped till 12:30, and Captain Fritz released him at that time. And Jim Braden, if you read the book The Legacy of Doubt by Alfred Noyes, which you should read, Jim Braden was a member of the Defense Intelligence Security Command also. He was in the Daltex building. I'm giving you the frame-up of the Dallas scene that day. Albert Osborne, the man I've mentioned on other programs who sat with Oswald going down to Mexico City, who hired the gunman who works for the defense intelligence agencies, was seen leaving Dealey Plaza. Manuel Gonzalez, a Mexican professional, fired from the side of the fence. That was the shot where the smoke went up, and the men were running, the Secret Service and police, to the fence. He stayed at Tammy True's house. Gonzalez is one of the men that slept at Tammy True's house on the 23rd, and also Seymour. These two men were gunmen, and they slept at the home of Jack Ruby's stripper November 23rd. That's the kind of these pimp psychiatrists, you know, who write these things as mental derangement. I'm telling you the names of the gunmen and where they slept. November the 23rd, they stayed at Tammy True's house. And David Ferry, whose name you know if you're into research, he worked for the CIA with Clay Shaw in the CIA, and his name is mentioned in the news this week as being down in Mexico under the direction of Howard Hunt. David Ferry and a Mr. McEwen met a Mr. Cody. They were professionals. They met at the Houston airport, and Ferry flew an airplane, and he took these men to a town called Matamoros in Mexico. Ferry was interviewed by the newsmen in Dallas the day of the assassination. Later, he flew to Alexandria, where he was met by two other men, Coffey and Babouf. And David Ferry died the day after Jim Garrison started his investigation and arrest of Clay Shaw. He was hit by a karate chop at the back of the neck. There were two men named Breck Wall and Joe Peterson who had connections to Jack Ruby that were involved in Las Vegas and the syndicate organized crime. And I know they stayed at the Dolphus Hotel where Jack Ruby was the afternoon of November the 23rd. Breck Wall and Joe Peterson left November 23rd, the day after Kennedy was killed, and they left the Dolphus Hotel and went to pick up William Seymour at the Bundan Life Temple. He's the man who killed Officer Tippett. And they drove to the Driftwood Motel in Galveston, Texas, where David Ferry picked them up. and they hit in Batcliff, Texas, a few days, and then they were flown out of town to Mexico. Breck Wall and Joe Peterson were contacted. I have the name of the contacts and how they got to the Adolphus Hotel. They were talked to Jack Ruby on the evening of the 23rd, and I have a list of people that Jack Ruby talked to, and that's the kind of schizoid paranoia. The doctors, pimps, they're the most terrible kind, push out this stuff in magazines called Mental Health. It has no basis in fact. John Kennedy was shot from a fatal shot. Highly trained Mexican professional assassins. The fatal shot came from the side of the fence, the one that blew his head. It did involve Tammy Drew. I gave you the dates. The men that took the marksman out of town, where two of them were picked up. And it involves a man named Santana, who was Emilian Santana, who also had told Jim Garrison a lot of this information, stayed with Tammy Drew, worked with Jack Ruby, Clay Shaw, the CIA, through an organization called the Double Check Organization that was a cover for the CIA. All of this conspiracy began after World War II with Bill Stevenson of British intelligence, whose operatives, along with our CIA, are behind the Patricia Hearst kidnapping. I'm just winding up my article now. Why was Patricia Hearst kidnapped? And like the Watergate story that was the first in the country after their arrest to put down what I think is a definitive explanation of what the people were doing at the Watergate Hotel, naming President Nixon, John Mitchell, Patrick Gray. The Hearst story that I'm doing begins at the Tyro Club in North Jamaica, where men like John Connolly and Paul Rogatorodsky and other people, John DeMeneal, meet in a northern Jamaica island at the Tyro Club on Montego Bay. And it is there where Stevenson of British intelligence met with American intelligence and Reinhard Gehlen of Nazi intelligence to set up the CIA and eventually to spread terror and riots and unrest in America as an excuse for the eventual control of America. And they've been overthrowing the electoral process for a long time. Most of this came under the supervision of Defense Security Division of the National Aeronautics and Space Administration, headed by Wernher von Braun, the German Nazi rocket scientist. Their address is 3990 East Broad Street, Columbus, Ohio. And it's no wonder that our Attorney General William Saxby is saying last week, we have enough already, the nation can't stand another shock. Mr. Saxby comes from Ohio. He's known there. It's the state, not only of Kent State, but a lot of conspiratorial activities took place there. Gordon Novell of the CIA went to Ohio when Jim Garrison wanted to arrest him, and he stopped in Virginia first. He said, I'm CIA. He stayed in Ohio, and he was never extradited. The chain of command is coming down every week, and the operatives who are involved, they're surfacing, and that's important because that is the only way it is ever going to open up as these people speak. Even though David Ferry is dead, and Ruby is dead, and Oswald is dead, there's a link here between Carlos Prio Siqueiros, the former president of Cuba, and Frank Sturgis down in Miami, and Bernard Barker, the Bay of Pigs operation. And the researchers are getting information from all over of how the pieces fit together, and there's still enough people alive willing to talk. So after 10 years, since the assassination of John Kennedy, the pieces are coming together every day. And I think it's important to keep up the interest with Congress and let them know that you want this thing open. The news this week is that they may open up the Rosenberg case. They're opening up the James Ray case. The Sirhan case is wide open. It has to be opened up. There's a wonderful book. We'll go into a little bit on the Watergate now and mingle it back to what these people were doing in 1972, because it goes all the way back to 73. There is a book I might have mentioned on my shows before. If not, I think you should get it. It's called Watergate, Crime in the Suites, and it's written by Michael Meyerson. The address is 381 Park Avenue South, New York, 10016. Or you can write to KLRB if you missed this. And in our local community, the Thunderbird Bookstore has it. It's called Crime in the Suites. And it's a very good analysis, a biography of people involved in the Watergate. And there's several sentences that are important. He says, if the government's personnel were changing quickly, the pace was exceeded by changes in the president's explanation of affairs. In September 1972, Richard Kleindienst pledged the most extensive, thorough, and comprehensive investigation since the investigation of the Kennedy assassination. Since opinion polls have found that barely a third of the country believes the official findings of that investigation, the Attorney General's announcement hardly put the nation at ease. Nixon then tried something better at a news conference, and he said the investigation of the Watergate was so complete and thorough they make the 1948 congressional investigation of Alger Hiss look like a Sunday school picnic. Another assertion not really tailored to gain the public's confidence. And this book goes into the power of the United States, how corrupt it is, how a handful of people manage 94% of the planet's population and make them aliens, that how corrupt the U.S. business world is and their ethical standards and their standards of social relationships and the necessity for advertising men who are dishonest and corrupt in Washington running the White House, and the necessity for war-related contracts, aircraft, oil, chemicals, electronics, and deprivation of problems in our country. He says, from its inception, our country has witnessed barbarism against the populace for the purpose of private accumulation of wealth. Black men and women kidnapped by the millions, brought to our eastern shores to make cotton king of the southern economy. And he goes into the slavery and pushing the native Indians away from their home and herding them up. And the Watergate is simply one extension of this gross mismanagement of life, just to push it against the wall, you know, to the breaking point. And that's what Watergate was about. He says that 72 is the most important year in gaining control of people because they're catching on to what's happening. And that was the gist of my articles, that they had to do control people with violence, with assassinations. They had to control the elections by stealing the ballots, by manipulating the candidates, by drowning a girl, by shooting, paralyzing another candidate, and murdering a president, murdering a senator. And there's this desperation to manipulate people to maintain the oil or the energy or the labor in the hands of a few people. And with cassettes and newspapers and radio programs and education, the awareness is so high that this is the year where they had to appear not overtly fascistic, but manipulate now or never. And so they put $20 million of secret money into the now, because they don't want the never. The Watergate affair, it's been 2 years, and what has happened? The judiciary is dropping charges. They want to drop charges. They have a list of charges, and I have a list of things they're not going into. It's amazing. There's 56 charges, but just to list them on paper and then list what's happened with the arrest is so horrendous, the contrast of the slap on the wrist for what these people were doing, because one charge alone affects masses of population. And there's 56 charges, and they want to drop them just to 37. And the whole thing is that they'll get each person and offer them immunity, give them 30 days, 40 days, 60 days, suspended sentence, in order to say, oh, we'll go for the big one. And then the big one, like Nixon, will be like Agnew. He'll just take trips and walk around and be a millionaire. And they've let 125 people off to get Nixon when he'd be out in 4 years anyway and couldn't run for re-election. He's only got 2 more years to be out, and he's never going to prison. So 125 people or more are getting off just on the excuse to get Nixon. Here are some of the charges in the last that have surfaced in the last year, and Jaworski does not intend to punish appropriately any single one of them. If you remember, he was a member of the team of the Warren Commission. One of the charges was the president's impounding of funds earmarked by Congress for domestic programs. Well, that just, you know, that implies education, old age, health, clean air, prosecution of minority leaders, unemployment, impounding of funds, these whole two years that Congress worked to give to domestic programs. Another charge of the illegal bombing of Cambodia, done secretly, and that goes into Admiral Moore, who became chief of staffs and was promoted, replaced last week, but the illegal bombing. Third, possible involvement in the June 72 burglary of the Democratic headquarters and the cover-up. The possible involvement, the overthrow of the electoral process is what it was. It was using the CIA domestically, hiring violence, making hotel reservations for provocateurs. There was forgery in those offices. There's no charge of forgery listed at all for any of these men, copying letters and signatures, sending their names Another charge was Nixon's personal finances at Key Biscayne and San Clemente. That was $17 million, more than all presidents have made in salary since George Washington. He put into two homes, and the taxpayers paid for it. White House threats or promises of government favors in exchange for illegal corporate campaign contributions. Well, they've listed a few illegal campaign contributions: American Airlines, Minnesota Mine, and Goodyear Tire, India, Interoceanic Corporation, Braniff Airways, Gulf Oil, Ashland Petroleum, Phillips Petroleum, Carnation Company, Diamond International, American Shipbuilding, Northrop, and Lee Valley. Well, all of these pleaded guilty. The corporations may be paid $3,000 fine, $5,000. What is a $5,000 fine to an airline that, in exchange for putting the secret money for Richard Nixon, raises the fares all over the country where transportation is prohibitive to large masses of population? The profit from the airlines, the oil companies, immediately after the elections goes up. They pay a fine of $5,000 and they make $1 million just by getting their president in. What kind of a slap is it on the wrist? And then the companies are charged. Nobody in the office, the head president of the companies, just get a $1,000 fine, which is nothing from their pockets, not even a week's salary. So that there is illegal corporate campaign contributions. Then the Environmental Protection Agency failure to prosecute anti-pollution laws. They're given a little slap on the wrist. Well, what about the rivers that are polluted? You can walk on it. What about the chemicals in the lakes? Seafood contamination, the loss of crab, of mussels, shrimps, lobster, all along the border, birds, wildlife, all these things are being killed off. But this is just one of the charges that they didn't carry out their anti-pollution. Attempt to abolish the Office of Economic Opportunity. That's one of 56 charges. 13 top officers of the Office of Economic Opportunity are CIA. They're described in this book on the Watergate affair. The people that Richard Nixon appointed to the Office of Economic Opportunity could be nothing but deprivation, from far right-wing Nazis and racists. How could they possibly care? Here's a list, for example. Howard Phillips, the head of the Office of Economic Opportunity. The chief inspector of that group is Eric Biddle, the ex-CIA agent who oversaw two dozen inspectors. Among them was Ray McConnon, a CIA intelligence analyst and investigator for the House Internal Security Committee, Peter Spaulding, Army intelligence involved in planning and coordinating CIA investigations and FBI, Early Morgan, formerly government supervisor in the field of counterespionage and Army counterintelligence, Gerald Crawford, Army intelligence, Rene Franceschi, 20-year man in Army intelligence. This is the Office of Economic Opportunity. Thomas Fitzpatrick, formerly the San Francisco Police Red Squad, Robert Lindenbrandt, Chief Deputy Sheriff of Modoc County in California. That group, if it was for opportunity, it's hard to understand how minorities would get a fair chance, get fair lawyers. So everybody that appealed to them, they'd have a list of where your head was at, who were the activists. And after they abandoned this office, the many people's paroles were denied because they had no lawyers. Many minority people are in jail. The jail population grows. It requires new jails, and those are new contracts, new guards. In other words, the service that they were doing, and I have the statistics at home, were so fantastic, and you take away those services and you build a new industry, which is prison guards and prison jails. So just the crime of abolishing the office doesn't describe maybe 10 or 15,000 lives or 20,000 lives or more than that, that are families totally affected, husbands and fathers and young people, you know, growing up with no chance before the courts because there's no lawyer to represent them. There's another charge of Nixon's ordering combat troops to Cambodia without the Senate study or knowing it. How many lives are involved in that operation? Another charge is the investigation of the milk fund cases and the contributions in exchange for raising the price of milk. How many people are doing without milk? The milk charge case, the only one that was indicted or suggested in the indictment, was Jake Jacobson in February 24th. He got indictment on one count of making a false statement to the grand jury, and he pleaded innocent, and the indictment was dismissed on technical grounds. That's justice in America. Meanwhile, across the board, the milk profits have gone up. The price of raising a family, the cost of living, I read this week, was $1,200 for four people in a family. Milk is a basic ingredient for health and ice cream products and cheese. This is one of the 56 charges against the president. The only man charged was Jake Jacobson, and his case was dismissed on technical grounds. There was a possibility of fraud and underpayment of taxes of Richard Nixon. And compare that investigation of his of underpayment of taxes with how many people are paying taxes who can't afford it. The use of the Internal Revenue to get people, to get even with them, to give them lengthy investigations, go into all their funding and the hassle. There was one of the charges was Nixon's connection with the White House plumbers, the operation and the dirty tricks. Well, that sounds very broad. Nixon's relationship to the White House plumbers. What about the massive evidence of Haldeman's secret money to defeat Wallace, $400,000, and passing it along, and Congressman Mills' money, that $25,000, indications that they paralyzed. Well, some of the dirty tricks could paralyze a man who's sitting in a wheelchair in extreme pain for the rest of his life. That's just one of 56 charges against the president, the plumbers. They don't even mention the Wallace shooting or the drowning of Mary Jo Kopechne, the blood on her blouse, or where it came from, the use of Lasowitz and Caulfield. They don't talk about what the Cubans were doing in J. Edgar Hoover's apartment, or how Hoover died without an autopsy, or the fact that he was murdered, Wallace crippled, or they take a woman like Dita Beard and hospitalize her, keep her out of Washington, D.C. It's going on 3.5 years now, isolated. Her room's bugged. Her guards are killed. They just pass off the White House plumbers, Lasowitz, Caulfield, Hunt, the whole team, Liddy. They were all involved in the Chappaquiddick, the Wallace affair, the Dita Beard, and Ted Kennedy, and that's just written off as Nixon's connection with the White House, and all of these four operations had to do with eliminating the people who were running for office or could alter the election in some way, and that's just written off as the plumbers' operation, and the investigation isn't going into it at all. Another charge was political contributions allegedly made in return for favors from Howard Hughes, Vesco, ITT, and Derry. That's all thrown in. The Vesco connections, the suggestion of heroin traffic through the Bahamas, through Southeast Asia, the airplanes, and linking to Roy Cohn, or chain of command of heroin traffic, just written off as political contributions in return for favors. Well, what specifically were the favors? That's why Jaworski is there, not to get into the favors at all. Those are some of the charges that they may go into. Now, here's some that they wanted to drop. Number 13 that the Jaworski wants to drop, or the committee to get the president out, call it impeachment, and he's been there 2 years already. Contributions from foreign nationals. You know, why not be specific? They don't mention Tom Pappas and Greek money, how that affects oil prices or military bases in Greece, future war in the Mediterranean in exchange for Greek money, keeping Greece militarily tight, sending them arms. Contributions from foreign nationals that came out last week. Jack Anderson had articles about the Shah of Iran siphoning some of that money into the bank that Bernard Barker had, that they were using at the Watergate and coming in through Mexico, those secret accounts. Go to the gasoline station and see how your gasoline's gone up, your oil's gone up, how much it takes to run your car. And the Shah of Iran is pumping money into Richard Nixon's campaign through Mexico, up to the United States. And we pay the price for the milk, we pay the price for the oil, and they want to drop the charges of international money. And we talk about the arms sales to Greece and the Arab countries. Energy, gas, oil, all goes up, and they drop the charge of contributions from foreign nationals. I surely believe it makes a difference which foreign nationals are giving the president money if it's coming from the Philippines, because we put martial law in effect over there and create a dictatorship in exchange for certain resources that are over there that particular people in this country accrue wealth from. So they just write that off. We'll drop the charge on foreign nationals. Another charge was illegal contributions to labor unions. Why do they write that off? Where does Mr. Meany get his power? Why does Walter Werther murdered? What about Yablonsky? How does that affect the United Mine Workers, men that go down in the mines, you know, they don't have fair wages that want to be represented in those unions, or the contracts to kill Cesar Chavez and moving the Teamsters in to squeeze out Chavez, and the lettuce strike, the grape strike, the wine picking, grape picking out here in California, around the country. They said, we'll drop the charges on illegal contributions from labor unions. Why? They pump money into the president, and then he puts the army, the CIA, and the FBI to protect those people, whether they're labor unions or grape growers or whatever. That's why you heard on the news service the FBI has airplanes, because they put money into the presidency, and he in turn funds the agencies that protect those people that put money in keeping him in office. It's that vicious circle. There's another charge they're dropping, granting a Minnesota bank charter in exchange for political contribution. Why should they drop it? Why should a Mr. Andrews or anybody not be investigated, or Bebe Rebozo gets a bank, another man squeezed out down in Florida, and members of the Republican Party or people that give to Richard Nixon get bank charters? What happens to the free enterprise system? Can anybody, any group, make money off of banking, or is it only going to be in the hands of a few people, the clique of the White House, who get all the banking charters, get all the loans for housing, all the loans for whatever people need, and they're the clique that the White House has selected to get the bank charters? There's another charge they're dropping, the failure of the Commerce Department to enforce safety regulations. What were some of the safety regulations? Clothes that are inflammable, carpets that are inflammable, children's toys with poisoning on them, paints that are poisoning. Who is suffering? All these charges are dropped, and who is suffering? The people. The kids are poisoned, the building walls have lead paint on the walls that's falling off, the kids are getting poisoning from, or adults. The milk's going up, the gasoline's going up, clothing that catches fire, carpeting that catches fire. Why do they have to drop charges of anything? And in the Watergate trial, when you see all the charges, these people aren't charged for these crimes of even the arson at the Brookings Institute. They're not charged for arson. All they're charged for is conspiracy to obstruct justice, obstruction of justice, making a false statement. When I go down the list of the Watergate charges of Fred LaRue and Magruder, sentencing deferred, these are their charges: conspiracy to obstruct justice, defraud the United States, obstruction of justice, perjury, conspiracy to obstruct justice, making a false statement to the FBI, making false statements to the grand jury, one count of obstructing justice. This goes on and on. They're not telling you what specific ways they affected our lives, how these men affected everything around us, the food we eat, the air, the rivers, the lakes, the shores, the, you know, everything that is affecting the way we breathe or what we wear or what's in our environment. They are contaminating and polluting, and they're getting 30 days for not telling the grand jury what they were doing. They're getting 30 days or 40 days for conspiracy to obstruct, or they get immunity at trials, and they get off with good behavior. Donald Segretti got 6 months in jail playing golf and going home for the weekends on good behavior for a sentence, when the Senate has a 350-page book on just what Donald Segretti did at the time of the Watergate, the amount of dirty tricks he did. There's a document of 350 pages of just Donald Segretti alone inviting people to dinners, black people, and having insulting them, having nobody be there, and they were terrible racial things. I don't even like to think about them or talk about them on the air, and having picnics and ordering tons of pizza, nobody paid for them, nobody showed up, and sending letters forged that nobody knew were going out in the air, having airplanes land at fields where nobody was there to meet them, the lights were out, the planes could have crashed. There's a whole chain of command of things that Segretti did alone, hiring maybe up to 90 people to work with him, lawyers disguised as Democrats or Republicans, sabotaging. He gets out on good behavior. And one charge, Donald Segretti got one charge of distributing illegal campaign literature. That just knocked out Muskie, you know, putting acid in Muskie's drink. Nobody got a charge for kidnapping, poisoning, forgery, any of these things. Harold Howard Hunt hasn't been charged for forging Kennedy's signature on the documents from the State Department that said he ordered the death of Diem. Well, they dropped the charges of arson, planned arson or firebombing against the Brookings Institute. They dropped charges of possible criminal fraud of Nixon, underpayment of his taxes. The investigation of the Hughes donations to Rebozo and the Nixon brothers, these charges have temporarily been shelved. It's among the 13 they don't want to go to. Another charge was funnel payments to the Watergate defendants, like blackmail. money to go to McCord and Hunt, and these people, they're not, they're trying to see if Nixon authorized payments to hush them, but they're not punishing the other people. They're not going into the plane crash where Mrs. Hunt had $2 million with her and not the small amount of money they said. James McCord made it clear when he testified before the Senate Select Committee, he said he could burn every tree in the forest. And E. Howard Hunt said, I could tell of all the seamy things I did. And because these two men worked in the CIA, one of them for 21 years, one for 19 years, there's no way that Leon Jaworski is going to let any of these men have a harsh sentence, because they all were involved in the heavy material. Wallace shooting, Mary Jo Kopechne's death, the Robert Kennedy assassination. They go way back. John Kennedy assassination. The team is so tight a click that if any one of them gets in jail, they can blackmail all of them. And that's why you're seeing the light sentences. Fred LaRue, Jeb Magruder, Dean Colson, Haldeman, Ehrlichman, Strom. They have to get off. They have to get off. The excuse they're giving them is, we want to get the big one. So they're all the way up to Haldeman, Ehrlichman, and they'll get off. And Kaulbach got a light sentence today, and Kleinitz got a ridiculous sentence, a little slap on the wrist. Kleinitz got off. John Mitchell was cleared in the Vesco case. Kleinitz got a suspended sentence of 1 month in jail and a $100 fine. Well, there was another charge that they're not going to put on them. And we could go on, we could do a four-hour anniversary of the Watergate. I'm just running down some of the charges that evolved or were exposed, which you're covering up, and I want you to be aware of how much there is to cover and how it affects our lives, and they're getting away with so much, it's terrible. One of the charges was a 17 illegal wiretaps and their concealment. I can't stand Henry Kissinger. He was part of the Plumbers Group, Egil Crow, David Young, the National Security Council, Mr. Haig. They knew that the leaks that were coming out weren't the only problem in the White House. If Mr. Kissinger is angry, he tells us that he's impartial. He's impartial about the India-Pakistan deal. He tells us publicly, and he's tilting it one way or the other. Why shouldn't he be exposed? To expose him is patriotic, because if they can say, I have no opinions, or I'm not going to tell you what I'm doing, but those public figures are pathological liars that stand up there day after day and tell one lie after the other. And they want to slap this fine on now. I talked about it last week, and you could write to members of the Senate who are totally helpless. Richard Helms wants a $10,000 fine and 10 years in jail for talking about work that people did in the CIA. You can see how desperate he is to get it when men are talking about E. Howard Hunt working with Clay Shaw and David Ferry in Mexico City with Oswald. They're desperate to shut this thing up. And the Senate this week is totally hopeless. They had a new vote in Congress June the 6th. What was the bill before the Senate? Intelligence spending. The Senate, by a 55-33 vote, rejected an amendment to require the CIA to divulge the amount of money concealed in the president's annual budget. Imagine, they spend $9 billion now, $9 billion in the CIA intelligence, and all the certain members wanted the Senate was to know how much you spend a year. And the people that wanted this bill to pass said, tell us how much you spend. And the people that didn't want it passed said, no, the adversaries would then deduce what kind of intelligence activities we have, which is just a terrible lie. And the bill for secrecy, even after the Watergate, after 2 years, and I've only spent, a short amount of time. I've got 4 hours of crimes they did, and we've got 1 minute to go. They voted 55-33 for the CIA not to have to tell you how much money it gets. So 55 senators voted that we should have unlimited money to the CIA, and you don't even have to know how much. It's been 2 years since the Watergate. The reason we have the Patricia Hearst kidnapping is that we didn't get into the dirty tricks. The SLA is the CIA. I'm writing on it now, and next week I'll read you the outline of the article that I'm doing. It'll be completed by then. It's not a very good anniversary, but we've gone a long way because people are surfacing now to tell the truth. Give them the support you can. Write to the Senate, and we'll see you next week. Keep well and stay safe. Bye-bye.
This has been Dialogue Conspiracy with political research specialist Mae Brussel, who for over 10 years has been researching the facts behind the political assassinations in this country so that the truth may be revealed. Dialogue Conspiracy originates with KLRB-FM in Carmel, California.